Tibet has captured the attention and imagination of the West for decades, even centuries. And in its 60-plus years under Chinese domination, it's been the subject of Cold War espionage, international diplomacy, and political protest here in the United States.
But how did Tibet end up under Chinese control, and what does the future hold for the Tibetan people? Our next guest tells the story of Tibet in the international arena.
Leslie Brown-Halper is with us. She's a Tibet scholar, a research associate at Corpus Christi College at Cambridge, and co-author of the new book, Tibet, An Unfinished Story. Leslie, welcome to the show.
Thank you both for having me today.
Well, your book contrasts the mystique that Tibet has in the West with the difficult political realities. Let's start with the Tibetan myth, in a way. Why did people in the U.S. and Europe become fascinated with Tibet over the years?
And as you just said, our book is really about two Tibets. Mm-hmm. So one of these stories is about their quest for independence. And in a second dimension, it is the story of the Tibetan myth. And some of your listeners might know it's the longest enduring myth in the West. And it started in the 5th century with Herodotus, a Greek historian and scholar who found gold-digging ants on a high mountainous plateau. And it goes all through the centuries, really, until it comes till about 1904 when it was opened to the West through the Brits with Sir Francis Younghusband. But we really see the myth take hold here, say, in the West and the rest of the world, the West will say, and in the United States in 1933 with James Hilton's book, Lost Horizon. And then you see Shangri-La and the myth of Tibet really become part of the vernacular, and people become enamored with this otherworldly place where we're talking about telepathic lamas and all this mysterious goings on, and then you really see it take hold.
And alongside that myth, as you say, there's the political reality, and there's been a long history of great powers competing for control or at least influence in Tibet. British and Russians, U.S., China, India, the list goes on. Why has it been such a battleground of international politics?
Well, it really the British really controlled most of Lhasa since, as I mentioned, 1904 until the Chinese invaded in October of 1950. But there was intrigue. The Brits, of course, thought that the Russians were coming in there. But I think that these countries became involved because Lhasa was a small, insular, and naive government. When they finally realized that the Chinese were going to invade, they looked to India, they looked to the United States, and then they looked to Britain for help. And these countries eventually became involved, but it was very difficult. The United States was preoccupied domestically and had other priorities abroad and really couldn't help. Britain post-war was constrained financially. They couldn't help. And then there was India, who had inherited all the rights and obligations to Tibet in 1947, and the Indians believed that their security and required that they cooperate with Beijing. So the Tibetans were looking to these great powers, but really didn't get very much help, overt help, I would say. But in 1956, with the Eisenhower administration, finally the United States gave covert assistance in a very romantic, daring operation in Tibet.
We'll get into some of that in a bit, but on that eve of the Chinese conquest, after Britain had given up its colonies in South Asia, was there a widespread belief, apart from in China, that Tibet would be an independent country at that point?
The Tibetans always wanted their independence, and various times throughout their history, they have been independent. They've had this priest-patron relationship with China, and the Tibetans clearly believed that they were independent. They wanted this, but I don't think that the United States, Britain, India ever believed that the Tibetans would be independent. Clearly, when the Brits had control, they acknowledged that the Chinese had some sort of suzerainty or relationship over the Tibetans. And the United States looked to Britain, and they deferred to Britain on what if Tibet had sovereign rights or could get independence. And then there was Prime Minister Nehru, who said, nope, we're not really going to do anything about this.
So China launches a military occupation, as you mentioned, in 1950. They did not describe that as an invasion, but as a domestic issue. Why did communist China say, in effect, hey, Tibet is and in effect always has been part of China?
Well, it's a very good propaganda effort on part of the Chinese. I think that this is all part of the revisionist propaganda of the Chinese. And, of course, they believed that Tibet had always been a part of China, and they wanted it back as part of the motherland, much like they wanted Taiwan. And they really wanted, at the time, the resources in Tibet. I think it was a huge plateau, not very populated. They wanted the uranium. They wanted the minerals. They wanted the water. And Mao made that clear when he spoke to a young Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama was 15 years old in 1950. And when they met, he made it clear to that young Dalai Lama that, you know, you have a vast land. We have a lot of people. We need the resources in Tibet. And they were prepared, really, at the time to do anything to make sure that Tibet was secured for what they called as part of the motherland in those years.
And the United States has had, it seems, an ambivalent role through this time. As you mentioned, espionage efforts to help Tibetan resistance in the 50s. But alongside that, always the hope that we, the United States, could detach China from alliance with the Soviet Union, so we didn't want to go too far to ruffle their feathers. Is that right?
We just were really constrained, as I said. I mean, we were constrained. The United States at the time was just, we had other priorities. Let's look at what happened. We'll say in the 1950s, the United States, both the Truman and Eisenhower administrations, they were limited domestically and geopolitically. Let's say domestically, they had the Henry Luce, the China lobby, and they had the Catholic Church, all believed that the United States had to support Chiang Kai-shek's nationalists in order to thwart the communists. And so these administrations needed the nationalists in order to fight the communists, and the nationalists, like the communists, believed that Tibet was part of China. So there really wasn't anything that the Americans could do then overtly. And then the U.S. was constrained by the geopolitics of South Asia. And at the time, Washington believed that India would offer the best hope for regional stability. But not only were relations between Washington and Delhi very strained, as I mentioned earlier, the Indians were going to cooperate with Beijing. In terms, they shared a 2,000-mile-long border, and they weren't they believed their interests were best served by not doing anything about Tibet.
We're talking about Tibet's past and future. We'll get into the role of the Dalai Lama, a unique figure in many ways on the world stage. Our guest is Leslie Brown Halper, her new book is Tibet, An Unfinished Story.
You can join the conversation. Do you have a question about Tibet? Have you been involved in Free Tibet activism? And do you think Tibet gets enough international attention? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org.
We'll pick up the conversation after this look at the latest news with Noah Ovshinsky. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation about Tibet's past and future with Leslie Brown Halper, co-author of Tibet, An Unfinished Story.
You can join the conversation. Do you think Tibet should be an independent nation? Do you think the United States and other countries should work to help that happen? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or call in with your questions about Tibet. You can also email talk@WPR.org. Leslie, I want to talk about this unique role of the Dalai Lama. How has he evolved as a figure of opposition to Chinese control of Tibet?
I think he's in a very, very difficult position. While he would like to see more for Tibet, he originally, when he left in 1959, he came to India, and of course he repudiated this 17-point agreement that said that Tibet was part of China. And he at the time said that, yes, the Tibetans wanted independence. But of course, that has been tempered over the last decades. In 1988, with the Strasbourg Accords, you know, he called for autonomy, Whether or not today that would be possible, it's hard to say because it's very difficult. Many of these Tibetans are integrated now in Tibet, in Lhasa. So the Dalai Lama's rule is a bit controversial. There are some in Dharamsala in the diaspora community who would like to be more forceful against the Chinese, the Tibetan youth movement most particularly. And the Dalai Lama tries to call for peace. He tries to placate in some ways the Chinese. So he's in a difficult position right now.
We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line, wanted to know what level of influence does China have in changing the demographics in Tibet? He's heard of a push by China to push out native Tibetans, settle Han Chinese there.
Yes, that is correct. I'd like to put it this way. In 1950, when the Chinese went into Tibet, we would say that it was 100% Tibetan. In 1911, when the Manchu dynasty fell, the Tibetans had basically expelled any of the Chinese that were there. Now it's maybe 60, 70% Han Chinese. They do call it a type of colonization, a transfer of population into Tibet. You know, Mao and going forward to today, they've made it very, very clear that they want the Han Chinese in Tibet. And this is where you see much of the unrest and that you would find, especially in Lhasa, which today is under a lockdown. These Tibetans are not getting the jobs. They're not able to use their language skills because they don't have higher education in Tibetan. It's very difficult because the Han Chinese have come in. They've opened stores. They get the better jobs. The Tibetans have become, in a sense, marginalized.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Wade on the line in Milwaukee. Wade, hi.
Hello.
Oh, what did you want to bring up, Wade?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for covering this topic. I think it is critical for our species. It's a litmus test on the quality of our thinking, on our humanity demand. And so I absolutely endorse the idea that the international community and the global powers should be focused on resolving this. And I wonder sometimes why instead we seem to focus so much on a Middle East situation, in Israel and Palestinian situation, rather than over in Tibet. Why the disparity in these two situations that have some similarity?
Wade, thanks for the call. Why is the Middle East front page news and Tibet isn't, Leslie?
I think the Middle East is more important to the United States and to other countries geopolitically. I think that the United States, has a trade relationship with China. I think the U.S. finds itself in a very precarious situation. Every time the Dalai Lama comes over, the president is not allowed to meet with him in an official capacity. And I just think that the issue of Tibetans and human rights has sort of been relegated, way down to the bottom of the list. And like your caller says, I wish personally that it was a more important issue. But we're not talking sort of Middle East peace process between two nations. We're basically talking about Tibetans that are many of them who have assimilated into China, talking about getting their independence. But much of that independence movement has been quelled and silenced, so the world really doesn't hear about it as much, say, as the Middle East. And Israel, of course, the Arab populations, it's an important issue for the whole region, as I said, geopolitically, whereas Tibet doesn't hold that sway right now.
Wade, thanks for the call. We've got Tom in La Crosse on the line now. Tom, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm curious. China has approached Tibet very aggressively. Why have they not approached Mongolia the same way?
The Mongolians have seemed to have assimilated much more easily than the Tibetans. And it's not to say that they didn't have some of the same issues, but I think that the Chinese have been very, very surprised over these past decades that the more that they try to bring in infrastructure and throw money at the Tibetans, the Tibetans still want their independence. The Tibetans had their own language, their own culture. There's a sense of nationalism there, and that even after six decades, the Chinese cannot sort of stamp out the myth of Tibet and the Dalai Lama, who's out there, and he's promoting peace, and he's a very visible figure, and it makes it very difficult for the Chinese to, you know, to make this issue go away, because clearly it's not going away.
If there's a protagonist in your book, it is the Tibetan people. What is their life like? How are they enduring after these years, decades under Chinese rule?
I think it's a very, in that sense, it's a very sad story. We've been up there a few times. I've done many interviews, and you always feel your heart really goes out to these people. Again, as I just mentioned, they really are under Chinese rule. For example, they're not allowed to practice their religion. They're not allowed to have a picture of the Dalai Lama. That's an instant prison sentence. So one of the most important aspects of any culture really is language. And so they're not practicing their language. Mothers that I spoke to said that that's very sad. There's no oral history happening there because their history books have been changed to reflect a sort of a Chinese-authored history of Tibet. So the people, it is very difficult. At this moment, Lhasa, for example, is on lockdown. Most of the people don't have passports, are not able to travel. They're quite desperate to have the world know about their situation. So I would say that it's very sad. And again, the world is not hearing about what's going on with the Tibetans because the Chinese are very good at monitoring this in this sort of authoritarian government.
We'll leave it there. Leslie, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Leslie Brown Halper. She's a Tibet scholar, research associate at Cambridge, and co-author of the new book, Tibet, An Unfinished Story.